Pushkin. When RZA put the 9 members of the Wu-Tang Clan together, he didn't just form a rap group. He created a universe. Their debut album, Enter the Wu-Tang 36 Chambers, was released in 1993, at the peak of what many consider to be the golden age of hip-hop. It was so packed with classic releases that if you can believe it, Snoop's Doggy Style, Tribe's Midnight Marauders, and Wu's 36 Chambers all came out in the same month. But Wu-Tang was different. Sonically, RZA produced dark and gritty beats by manipulating old soul samples and splicing together sound bites from kung fu films. And lyrically, all 9 members had a unique style that was untouchable. RZA spent 3 decades as one of hip-hop's elite producers and has gone on to become an actor, director, and film composer, working with people like Quentin Tarantino, Bill Murray, and Denzel Washington. Rick Rubin caught up with RZA recently on Zoom. RZA says his creativity is peaking in quarantine. He reminisces with Rick about running around Staten Island with ODB as a kid. He also talks about the time he almost left everything behind to move to Wu-Tang Mountain in China. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and RZA.
What's been going on, man?
Man, yo, I've been sitting in my house, right? doing Zooms. But it's been good, because for me, I have the writer's room going for season 2 of American Saga. So a lot of work is getting done, ironically. Like, people are still working, and we're actually on schedule, because we need that in the midst of all this world confusion.
There's certainly less distractions from the outside world, so it's a good time to get work done.
I got to agree, especially the kind of work that we do, creative work. It's been, for me, my creativity is peaking in a way, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's like I've been in the gym and I've got creative muscles that I need to use, and they're ready to use. I've been playing with the MPC. I think I made 15 beats during the quarantine so far.
Incredible.
And that's a nice amount. It usually take a year to get that many, you know what I mean? From the way I've been working in the film. But being home every day, you know what it is, Rick? The hours we use for commuting is gone, right?
Yeah.
So those hours now come back to me, and I get to play in those hours.
How has your relationship to making beats changed from when you were starting to now?
Wow. The relationship changed in the sense of, before, I think I made beats with a purpose of, you know what I mean? A purpose of, it's going to be a record, a purpose of maybe I'm going to get some money for it, a purpose of being the best. I definitely wanted to be the best producer or the best hip-hop producer in the world. I had that summer-off feeling. And now when I make it, I just make it as an expression of almost like just entertaining myself. You know what I mean? There's no goal. There's no purpose for it. It's just like I'm just doing it, like just as if I was playing a video game. Just if I was playing my piano, my beat machine becomes that fun moment for me to go down, DJ a little bit of my OD on my DJ set, take a couple of samples. You know what I mean? Find some new synth sounds. I'm entertained by that.
You think if you could zoom out and look over your work from earlier when it was goal-oriented to now, you think that the goal-oriented part of your old work is what drove it, or was it just one of the aspects?
To be honest, the majority of my critically acclaimed work that, you know, like 36 Chambers, those beats were made with no goal in the sense of, or can I say, what's no economic goal? A lot of those beats was made because I was in my house, I had my beat machine, and I'm making beats. It's fun. You know what I mean? Brain the Pain, that was made having fun. Maybe after, I had a flood, you know, that washed a lot of my tracks away, like in 19, right before the big solo Wu-Tang solo albums, right? So maybe 94. Then, but I had made record deals with people, right? So I had to turn out a lot of work And I sat in that basement for years turning out a lot of work, meeting deadlines. And I succeeded at that, and it still wasn't a lot of money. But I think when the money got involved, I think at one point, and I'm not sad to say this nowadays, at one point, you know, maybe I was getting 100 plus a track, right? And around that range, I'm not even making music unless you call me with that money. You know what I mean? So the money became the dictator of my creativity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So what I can say for nowadays, and it could be from the blessings of being able to express myself in film or the blessings to express myself in other mediums, that when I make music, I'm making music purely for the expression of self, purely for my own entertainment. And maybe it's the best stuff I ever made. Maybe it's not.
Yeah. But it sounds like from what you're describing, your earliest and maybe some say think your most important work, the breakthrough works, were made right. without that pressure from the outside.
Yeah, I had a conversation with my Wu-Tang brothers about a similar conversation, not as on a nose as this, but we were talking about making an album, right? This was before we did our last album was called The Better Tomorrow. And, you know, I had to actually negotiate. You know, I made with brothers to get them to come and do the album. One dude wanted this much, one dude wanted that much. And I had to go through. It was a self-funded album in the beginning, meaning, you know, I think I'd take $1 million and invest it in myself, you know what I mean, into my crew. So I broke everybody off 100 G's there, 50 G's there, whatever. But I tried to bring it to that conversation. Like, yo, it should never cost money to make music. In the old days, the songs, like, take the song Method Man. That song came about because he came to my house on a Friday night with the weed. Okay? I had an 8-track recorder in my house, had a mic. I had just made a beat because I was making beats all day. He showed up. He had a couple of comic books, 2 bags of weed and some blunts. He had just finished doing his pharmaceutical work. And he came for some downtime. He rolled it up, he lit it up, he smoked it. I put the beat on, I plugged the mic in, he did the song. In fact, the electricity went out. We had to plug into my aunt's electricity downstairs. And we recorded it, right? And that's because that's what we wanted to do. And a lot of the whoops were in the early days is that you would come to my crib and come hang out and make a song. You wanted to do it. So I'll try to remind the brothers that, yo, we used to make music because that's what we wanted to do. You came to my house. I didn't ask you to come. I didn't pay you to come. It just was the place you came to let loose your verse, to hang out, smoke a blunt, play some video games, watch a kung fu flick, you know what I mean, make some music, you know? So a lot of our early stuff, a lot of songs, even you listen to the ODB first album, the Jizzle first album, the 36 Chambers, a lot of that is like remakes of what we did as kids.
Yeah.
Like we had the foundation. Listen to Liquid Swords, that same routine in Liquid Swords when the MCs came and all that. We made that probably when we was 15 years old with a pause tape. You know what I mean? And then when we got the album deal, I'm like, yo, let's bring back that old routine we used to play. And we did it and it became what it became.
How old were you guys when you made the first album?
First album officially, I was 21. As far as the first, Jizzle's album, you want to count that 19 when he made Words from a Genius. Yeah, so not bad.
No, incredible.
Not bad.
But you guys had already been percolating for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, yeah. Running around New York trying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Trying. You know, I got a question for you.
Yeah,
I got
to
hit you with this.
Of course.
So, Rock the Bells,
yeah,
right? You programmed the drums on that one?
Yeah.
And then, how about Jack the Rapper, Jack the Ripper, with the 707 Cowbells?
I can't remember, because I can't remember, was that on the first album or the second album? If it was on the second album, I didn't produce it.
It wasn't even on the album. It was like a B-side single that I think you guys had dropped back.
I honestly can't remember. I'd have to listen back.
Well, let me talk about Rock the Bells for a moment, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
So Rock the Bells, one of the hardest beats to hit the streets. Okay. And really a pioneering production for hip hop. And then the bells, man. Now that I'm a producer, I could imagine that that hit was a guitar hit, basically. LL Cool J is hard as, right?
Yes.
And it changes hip hop. It evolves it, to be totally honest. And I'm only bringing this up to give you some points on this, right? Because I remember being very egotistic about hip hop myself. Like, you know, it took me, like, I had to go to France, and I did an album called World According to RZA in the year 2000, and I had to travel around all these different countries and do music, right? And I'm seeing rappers everywhere, and I realized hip hop is a worldwide thing. But it did have its roots in America, right? But at one point, people said hip hop was black music. Wait a minute. And I said in an interview, wait a minute. And I'm glad that I was right. I said, Rick Rubin made Rock the Bells, okay? That's in the early phases of hip hop. So I'm not going to say that it's a black or white music, because Charlie Chase and the Fearless Four, he had Tito in the group. We got Rick Rubin producing the early drums on LL Cool J, probably Run DMC, okay? Point I'm making is that you got the Latin brother, you got the white brother, you got the black brother, all making hip hop. So when I was going through, you know, going through that, through these countries, you know, they was like, yeah, black, you know, black. I said, no, hold on, hip hop, we can't say it's an American, right? We should say American before we said it, because actually it's been pioneers from every aspect of our culture. Hip hop is actually a melting pot of our culture.
It's true, but maybe I will say in the early days, I always felt like the only white person in the room for a long time.
Right. Look, you know what? In the early days, even in my hood, there was only one white dude that lived in the projects, but that was our man.
Yeah.
You know, if you got dark chocolate, you put one spoonful of milk in it, it breaks it down a little bit. You know what I mean? So the point being made is that hip hop was one of the first, not one of the first, but definitely part of the American culture that is emerging of different people from walks of life. You know what I mean? Now the Asian influence may have not been identified or identifiable or in it. And it came in, but it was in it in a very mysterious way. If you go back and talk to Grandmaster Flash and you talk to some of these guys, you realize that some of their names, some of their vibes, they come from Kung Fu movies, right? You go back and you talk to some of the break dancers, you'll see that they picked up a couple of moves from some of the 42nd Street Kung Fu movies, right? But still, it wasn't identifiable. Then Wu-Tang comes and we put it right in the music. Basically, hip-hop is that culture that allowed the entire spectrum of American culture to exist creatively and combine, and then eventually become the culture of the world.
What was the hip-hop scene that you grew up in like? What were you seeing around?
For me, the first time I heard hip-hop was on Staten Island, 1976. It was a DJ named DJ Jones. The other guy named was Quincy. These are unknown DJs who unknown to the rest of the world. And then an MC named MC Punch. And they would bring their system out between the building 240 and 260 Park Hill. There was a parking lot there. They would plug up and they would do their jams.
How many people would come?
Maybe, you know, 80, 90, even if 100 people. The whole, because it's Park Hill, so everybody from all the kids from all the builders would come. I shouldn't be out there. I got my ass whipped for being out there because I'm 7, 8 years old, mesmerized, hypnotized by the music. And what he was playing was Apache. That beat, that vibe, it was whatever. That song made me want to get on the floor and roll around. You see? And the first thing I did was I tried to learn how to do, it wasn't even called breakdancing, Rick. It was called freestyling. I'm freaking off, do the freestyle. You know what I mean? And so that was my first thing. But then when the rapper was like, dip, dip, dive, so socialize, clean out your ears, then you open your eyes, right? That was probably a rap that he probably got from somewhere else. Who knows, right? Because so many rappers said it. But it hit me. And my cousin, Jizza, a couple of years older than me, he's the one that took me to the block party. He was already writing lyrics at that time. You know what I mean? Because I was living down south for a few years. So I just got back from down south. So imagine this. I'm coming back from down south. I'm 7 years old, going on eight. I hear this music. I'm mesmerized.
How popular was the music at that time? Would you say everyone your age liked it or no?
I don't know if everyone my age liked it, but I think no more than 150 people knew how to do it. You know what I mean?
Small community. It was a very small community.
Small community. Jizza told me he learned it from the Bronx, from Soundview Projects. He had a cousin up the Soundview Projects. He would go to their house and people would bring out sound systems there and they would do it. That's what hit him. So my style really could be traced back to the Bronx from the Jizza. You know what I mean? He brought it to Staten Island. And then, of course, you know, by the age of 9, I started writing lyrics. But and hip-hop is still new. It's never been on the radio yet. You know what I mean? I don't think even WBLI or HBI, HBI. Whatever. HBI, WHBI hasn't hit it yet.
No, I remember them hitting pre-Mr. Magic.
No Mr. Magic. No Supreme Team.
Yeah.
But you're still talking 78, 79. Now, Sugar Hill Gang comes in 79. But anyway, there wasn't a lot of people doing it, to answer your question. And it was mostly DJs catching a break beat. The samplers wasn't happening. I remember the first time I heard a sampler, I mean, of course, Marley in the early days, but that's like Marley's, what, 84, 85 now, the year he comes in? And what year is Rock the Bells for us?
I'm not good with dates, but I know, okay. I do know that when we made those first records, there was not a sampler yet. We didn't yet have a sampler.
Exactly. No sampler. Exactly. So that's the point. I'll make no samplers. So it's just the break beat, the DJ cutting it in. Maybe you had a four track, right? Yeah. And so it was primitive. But I do remember hearing Flash, Grandmaster Flash had a song called Flash, just on the beatbox like that. Yeah. And me and Dirty went to 14th Street, because 14th Street had all the electronic stores. You remember that?
Of course.
And we tried to go and find what the heck was a beatbox. And what we ended up getting was one of those rhythm boxes that they use in church for rhythms.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's the... Is that what Flash was talking about?
No.
I don't know.
I don't think so. Exactly. I don't think so, but maybe.
Well, that's the first thing I ever had.
Those were like Rhythm King. It's like it just has like a bunch of buttons to pick the style of beat. You don't program a beat.
You don't program it.
It has pre-programmed beats.
But if you hit two,
and you can just control the tempo.
Control the tempo. But if you press two of them together, it will do something awkward.
Absolutely.
Or if you keep holding the fill-in button.
Yeah,
so that was my first way of trying to produce. I had two turntables and one of those beat rhythm boxes. And then one day, there's a guy on Staten Island named Philly Phil, right? He comes outside with a 606 drum machine. Now, I mean, that changed the game. But we thought that was the masterpiece, right? But then Dr. Rock of the Force MDs or Force MCs, you remember DJ Dr. Rock?
Yeah.
So Dr. Rock, he comes out with a 707. So this is 19, now I might be in 1982 now. I'm in 82. 1982, 83, the 707 is on the block. Dr. Rock has it, and he invites me, Jizza, and ODB over to do a demo. I'm 14 years old, yo, at most. And we recorded a demo, and we just felt like we was going to be on top of the world. And this is before the Force MDs had their Tommy Boy deal. They won't get a Tommy Boy deal for another year, maybe. So anyway, point being made is that the 707 was like the machine to have. And then I had a DJ on Staten Island named Scotty Rock, right? Not to be confused with Scott LaRock.
Yeah.
But his name was Scotty Rock. and he came, he bought the 909. He had a pair of S, he had a pair of 1200 Techniques and a 909 drum machine. And I stayed at his house every day after school, making beats and making demos with him and another guy named B-Dub. And we had another guy from my high school named DJ Skane, who also had a dope echo machine. He's the one that had the Yamaha 4-track. You know what I mean? And I borrowed it. I borrowed this and borrowed that and borrowed that and brought it all to my house. And I just started making neighborhood albums. Me and ODB would make albums and put them out in the hood. But that's my earliest memories of hip-hop, you know, going back from 8 to 14.
I have to ask you, what was ODB like as a kid?
Wow. Beautiful, funny, crazy. At this age, let's say around the age of 9, 10, 11, he lives in Brownsville. Then he ends up moving to East New York. But I want to point out, he was one of those kids that we had this thing called cat agility. So cat agility means you got to jump from one balcony to another, run up the walls and all this. This is before parkour. It is basically the foundation of parkour. And Old Dirty was nice at it, yo.
Was it, you know, was it, man, inspired by the Kung Fu movies?
It may have been. I just feel like kids, it's like some kids just always start doing something. You know how kids are. Yo, can you jump from this bench to this? Yeah. How about this to this? And then every day it got more and more. Next thing you know, it's five kids and we all running in a row. And I was running with him. I wasn't never as good as him. He was like a natural. He could run up the wall and do a flip. So when breakdancing came out, he could do the windmill. I had to set the pop lock and I could not work the floor. And, you know, he got into hip hop first as a DJ. You know what I mean? I kind of forced him to be an MC. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I was his younger cousin, but I was taller. You know what I mean? And I had a little spirit, like a little pushy spirit, I think, at that age. I had got knowledge of myself at 11 and a half. You know what I mean? So, you know, by the time I'm 14, I'm already, you know, young Malcolm X mind. You know what I mean? And that energy kind of was pushy.
How do you decide to form? When I think of Wu-Tang, for me, it's the first group of its kind. It doesn't feel like a continuation of a lineage. But for you, who did you feel like it was part of a lineage of groups that had come before?
To be honest, look, there's other groups I got to give respect to. Cold Crush Brothers, like I said, Fantastic Freaks, or the Fantastic Five, the Furious Five, Treacherous Three, Fearless Four. I mean, I give all respect to those brothers, but I didn't see Wu-Tang Clan as none of that.
It's not. It's nothing like those.
It was more of a Kung Fu clan. You know what I mean? So there's certain movies that just really touched me when I was young. You know, there's a movie called The Brave Archer. And in this movie, The Brave Archer, there's a beggar clan. It's hundreds of them, man. And you know them, you know? Or even Shaolin, you know, the Shaolin movies. It's like there was a movie where every Shaolin got burned down and everybody had to flee and take their secret techniques. And you only knew one when they had certain hand signals. That became like my psyche, you know what I mean? The Five Deadly Venoms, you know what I mean? The Ten Tigers of Kwantan. In fact, the Ten Tigers of Kwantan, or Canton, if you pronounce it properly, is probably the movie that I could have modeled some of the Wu-Tang members as, you know what I mean? And there's another movie called The Eight Diagram Pole Fighters with eight brothers all fighting for the country, loyalists. And those two movies could be the movies that inspired me to realize that we can move as a clan, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not just Five Deadly Venoms, because five is a lot too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the move as a clan, I would think that I kind of was inspired by the art of martial art films, the chivalry, the brotherhood, the one man would die for the other.
How do you get into martial arts films?
My first movie I ever saw was a Tom Sawyer Huckleberry Finn movie. My second movie is Star Wars. My third movie is The Swarm. And my fourth movie is a double feature, which was a Bruce Lee movie called Fury of the Dragon, which was just an edited movie of all his Kato things put together, and Black Samurai with Jim Kelly, right? Those are my first five movies. And if you look at me as a, if you look at what that means to me, The Force is my spirituality, right? Lightsaber, The Swarm, Killer Bees, Wu-Tang Killer Bees, okay? The Kung Fu movies is all in my blood. You know what I mean? And I think the writing of Mark Twain and the storytelling is all in my blood. I think those early movies really like imprinted something on me. And plus the people who I was seeing them with. I was seeing it with my uncle, who was just, you know, a father figure in my life. He's the one that took the time to take me to see a movie, you know? And we're talking, you know, the man who would take you to the movie and talk to you after the movie was over, which I now do with my children. Now we don't just watch a movie. We watch it. After the movie's done, we sit down and we spend 15 to 30 minutes, maybe even an hour, depending on the movie, and we talk about it. So those movies probably have the big inspiration, but the Kung Fu movie had the biggest. And so then my cousin Vince had took me down to 42nd Street. It was a Kung Fu triple feature. So you can imagine, for $1.50. And so that became my stimulation, to the point that by the time I was a teenager, me and ODB, we would play hooky in those theaters. You know, we was those kids in the theaters with a joint, cutting school, watching movies.
We'll be back with more from RZA after a quick break. We're back with more from RZA.
How much would you say the smoking influences your creativity?
That's a great question right there. And I got to be honest, right? I started creating before I was smoking. I created a lot during my smoking. I got into an argument with my little brother about 5 years ago. My little brother, he's in a group called Killer Army, and you know, he's maybe 8 years, 9 years younger than me. And so he's the guy that looked at me, learned from me, and continues in hip hop. You know, I'm like his big brother that he's copying. And the more I got into drugs, the more he got into drugs. If I smoked it, he smoked it. Okay? Whatever I did, he did. If I chewed it, he chewed it. And I stopped about 5 years ago. I don't even smoke weed right now, bro. You know what I mean? I just chilled out. Like, I'm good. Like, if I smoke weed now, it has to be a total celebration of something great. Like, I got to get the Grammy or the Oscar or something really great for me to say I'm going to celebrate with that drug. And nothing against it. I smoked enough for two lifetimes. But the point I want to make is that he was like, yo, because I told him you should quit. You know, you should quit, especially the hard drugs. You should quit them. And he was like, nah, man, you crazy? All the greats, man, made their shit off of drugs. Jimi Hendrix, James Brown, Janis Joplin. You start naming motherfuckers. Say, even you. And I said, wait a minute. Let me think about that. I said, nah. I made 36 Chambers sober. Because remember, I was on trial. I couldn't get high. And I just kept making music and doing things sober. I said, and actually, I made my company. Everything I did was the best me was the sober me, right? He was like, he didn't believe me. I said, yeah. Then I said, you know what, two nights? When I went to do my movie, Man with the Iron Fist, I sobered up. I wrote it. I went to China, no drugs in China anyway. I stayed there for 9 months and I directed a film. I couldn't afford to be high. And I was able to operate all my creative abilities. So I'm only saying that I've made a lot of music while high. Bobby Digital's and all type of shit, bro. But I honestly got to say, and I can speak from the truth, that my creative energy is not generated from drugs. It's a self-generating desire to create. And like I said, I made 15 beats so far on this quarantine. No drugs in my house, bro.
Tell me about what was it like living in China for 9 months?
Thanks for asking. But that was the first word I'm going to say, lonely. And there's not a lot of blacks over there, bro. I saw like two blacks in 9 months. You know what I mean? Unless they came over with me. You know what I mean? Not a lot of us over there. I'll tell you how lonely it was. Now, we could say in America, we got racism, all right? If an average black guy dressed in my hoodie style and how I may dress, if I come across an average white guy, he might feel like, yo, what this dude gonna do, right? I'm in China, bro, at an elevator, about to go to my room, whatever, sitting there, and here comes a white guy, average white guy, from the Midwest. He hits the button. He looks at me. I look at him. How you doing, man? My name is Bob. Hey, what's your name? We became immediate friends, bro.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, you're not even hearing English, okay? And we talked about sports. He was out there. What you doing out here? He said, I'm out here with the Ford Corporation building a whole new plant. I'm building a plant. It's what you doing. So I'm making a movie. We became friends, yo. Now, no, maybe in America, that wouldn't have happened. He would have got on the elevator, got lost. But it was so lonely that even to hear somebody speak your own language and understand the culture of what America is, because it's a different, we have a unique culture, bro. Good, bad, or ugly is different. You know what I mean? And when I was over there, I recognized that. I felt that.
Describe a bit about that culture. Like, what are some of the differences for those of us who haven't been?
Well, I'm gonna go macro first. On a macro level, it's almost like everything looks like it's like the building looks like the building is gonna be. You walk in the building, it's gonna be the same, right? But it's not gonna be the same because the culture. It's a communist country, bro. Okay, you're dealing with communism. That means that the freedom of speech, the freedom of what you want to say, it's not really like that. You can't say it. Like, I couldn't say, they had to check my script and make sure that I was saying the right shit, yo. Now, I respect that. I respect their culture. But if you want to know about censorship and being controlled at the highest level, well, that's what they do. You know what I mean? And it's law.
Any other things that were you were not allowed to do? Anything that you said or any themes in the movie that were questioned? Yeah.
I couldn't say Shaolin in my movie.
Because?
Because Shaolin is historically a place in China that's historically real. And so they didn't want me to dampen their culture by saying Shaolin in my movie on a story that wasn't real to Shaolin. Now, I don't know why, because I don't see 100 movies with different stories about Shaolin. And I've been to China various times. So I went on a pilgrimage to China as well. And when I went on that pilgrimage, it was one of the greatest experiences of my life because I went to Shaolin Temple. I went to Wu-Tang Mountain. And the history of their culture, of what they preserved in their culture, is a blessing for the entire world because they got history 4,000 years still contained.
Beautiful.
And when I went there, it's not commercialized. Well, when I went, it wasn't commercialized yet. Shaolin became a little commercialized based on a lot of movies and a lot of tourism. Wu-Tang Mountains, it's hard to get to, first of all. It's not as easy to get to as Shaolin. And when I went there, it was real interesting because they had a different type of serenity about them. You know, so Wu-Tang Mountain is considered the birthplace of Tai Chi, Xingyi, and Bakwa, of course. And the monks there, although they're not celibate, they don't practice celibacy, but they practice internal before external, right? And it shows in their demeanor because their smile starts from their belly and then it comes out their face, you know what I mean? And it was big, strong smiles, big, strong energy. If I didn't have a family, and this is going to sound funny, because this only happened to me twice in my life. Now my journey is both with you. If I didn't have a family and children back home, I would never have left. I felt almost like Superman would have felt when he left Krypton and landed on Earth. That happened to me at the Wu-Tang Mountain. And then it happened to me when I was when I visited Africa. When I went to visit Ghostface, he was in Africa, and I had to go. I promised him if he'd go, I would visit him. And so I visited him. Promise I had to keep. But something about the way the sun was hitting me, it felt like, wow, I understand what Superman feels like.
We'll be back with more of Rick's conversation with RZA after the break. We're back with the rest of Rick's conversation with RZA.
Let me kind of get to a couple of questions in on you.
Yeah.
First drum machine.
First drum machine was an 808, and it was not mine. I was going to NYU, living in the dorm. There was a kid named Eric who was in a band, like a new wave band called the Speedies, who played at places like Danceteria or the, you know, Roxy, the Ritz, like those kind of clubs.
Yeah, I remember the Ritz. Yeah,
maybe Mud Club, if you remember that, downtown. But they played in more like alternative music clubs. And and even though he was in a rock band, he had an 808 drum machine. And this was, 808s had not really been used in hip hop yet. And there wasn't really so much hip hop. The culture existed, but there weren't so many records. All there were 12 inches.
Right.
And the 12 inches that there were, more often than I think, I'm trying to think if there were any exceptions, it was almost always a band played track. Because
right.
Even though, like, if you went to a hip hop party, what you'd hear at a hip hop party would be break beats and scratching, and maybe a DJ using a drum machine. I mean, maybe Grand Wizard Theodore was the first one I saw use a drum machine as part of his DJ set. The records were still being made like disco club records, but with guys rapping on them. You know, like all the Sugar Hill, right. The Sugar Hill records were not programmed. You know, they were played by right. a band, a house band. Even right. the Enjoy records were played by a house band. So I bought these records wanting it to sound like what I heard at the club, and it never did. It always sounded like right. a band playing and a guy rapping, where the thing that first excited me about the music was the DJing more even than the MCs. You know, it's like, right. I love the Treacherous Three, and they were exciting as MCs.
Right, it was nice.
Yeah.
As MCs, yeah.
But when I got to see, you know, Jazzy J cutting up breaks, beat, you know, break records and the Octopus right. records, if you remember.
Yep, I got, yep, the Octopus yeah, records, yep.
Incredible. So that felt more like what hip hop was to me. And again, I'd buy these records every week and none of them sounded like that. So when I decided to start making them, I never thought of it in any commercial way. I never knew that anybody would like it. I just tried to make a record that sounded like the club that I went to.
Wow.
Almost like a documentarian, you know, like I just want
right.
to, I want to hear this sound. I don't get to hear this sound. And then it kind of spread from there.
So now one of my crazy, I mean, of course, all the BCs, I know you produced all that. And that all that shit was crazy.
The first album, yeah.
Yeah, of course, that first, I'm talking about that first album.
Yeah.
First of all, I was so, when y'all had the horns, right, that was the break beat was called The Horns. But what's the real name of it, though?
I don't know.
I was like, me and the old, because see, we was also going to those record stores, buying all the Octopus breaks, putting them on our four tracks, making our demos,
yeah.
right? No sampler. So you got to cut it. The DJ got to cut it on the four track. Yeah. Then the rapper raps on top of it after, yeah. right? And we was trying to get, but when y'all came with that, man, we was like, they did it first. It was one song. No, because you know, we all dreaming. Once I heard Sugar Hill Gang on the radio, that's where I was headed. I will say that. When I heard them on the radio, I knew that's where I had to be one day. One day, that's what I'm going to be. I knew it was possible. But anyway, you know, so you produced all those ill joints and you took the break beats, mixed it with the drum machine. But on Together Forever. That's your programming, Together Forever, Run DMC, Tough and the Leather?
It was either me or Jam Master Jay, and I can't remember because we would work together in the studio on all the records. And
right.
Sometimes he would program the beat, sometimes I would program the beat. It was not exclusive.
Well, the coolest thing about that track was that that was all 808. And getting the 808, first of all, 808 wasn't an easy machine to program either.
No. Awkward.
It wasn't easy. Very awkward way of thinking. Getting one, there wasn't even a lot of them out there.
No.
So, I mean, there was more 707s than 808s, right? Yeah, 909 is more of those. But the 808s is like, no, you don't have one, you're not getting one. And so I never owned the 808 until after I was famous. Yeah.
It was considered a failed drum machine. You know, it was a flop of a drum machine when it came out.
Right.
Because it didn't really sound like drum. The whole idea of the drum machine was supposed to sound as much like drums. So there was already like Linn drums and the DX and DMX. We had a DX also. And on a lot of like...
That's the Oppenheimer, right?
Yeah. And on a lot of the Run DMC records, we would sync up the DX and the 808 together and just pick certain sounds from each and get them to play in sync. And then it made it sound like a new machine you hadn't heard before because it wasn't just either one of those drum machines.
Right, both, yeah. I mean, I recognize that, and I think Suck MCs is that the DX? Because I felt like Suck MCs was like an attempt, like a DJ, a programming of action.
Yeah, that's what it was. And Russell had that beat for action, and then he got Larry to program Sucker MCs based on action.
Okay, I always thought that as a I'm a young DJ, so I'm that young DJ scratching it all day, trying, you know, a few years behind you guys, just dreaming. You know what I mean? But the DX, I love how that one sounded. I think the shakers on that one was the best. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And it had that the swing function where you could get it to, which was really like the whole, what ended up becoming New Jack Swing.
Right.
That machine was the first drum machine that could create the beat that skipped in that way, that particular way.
Okay. Let me get a couple more in on you. So, because come on, brother.
Happy to. We can do this forever.
So you did, I'm glad, first of all, I'm glad we got a chance to work together finally on a Better Tomorrow. I was like, man, I said, how can I be on the planet and not get a chance to work with Rick Rubin? That's not supposed to be. Because Rick, I really appreciate what you did for hip hop, what you do for hip hop, what you do for music. And I watched you, right? I watched you as an example, right? And you did something that, I mean, you know what you did, but I just want to just say it out of my own mouth. Even after you helped build Def Jam, right? And can be, you know, I know you got people around you, whatever, that helped out, but can be the spearhead who combined hip-hop and rock together, bro. Okay, even with this guitar hit on Rock the Bells to the Aerosmith songs and all this stuff that eventually became a movement to help spread this culture, even after you separated from hip hop, you went to and made Def America, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there continue to push the culture. Like, I just remember some of the records that was coming out on there. I was like, It still has a hip hop vibe in it, even though the average critic didn't know what to write. No, they could write whatever, but no, it still had those foundations, and that's because you are producing it,
yeah,
right. And then you took it from there, and you know, we talked about Chavo, but you produced that first album for them.
I produced all the System of a Down albums.
Come on, bro. All right? Like, did you go to NYU to study music? Like, what were you studying?
No. I started as a philosophy major and then switched to film and television because all of my friends were in film and television. It just seemed like the classes were more fun. So I just switched. I'd rather watch movies than discuss philosophy at that point in time.
Right. That's crazy because you think about all the records you produced that you know, that's Grammy winning, groundbreaking. Like, if somebody go, and of course, you know, people bring you up to the, you know, say the Dixie Chicks, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But if somebody was to just say, if somebody, like, take 50 years, 100 years, 20 years from now, somebody start off with one of your Dixie Chicks songs, right? How deep they got to dig, or how would their consciousness go, wait a minute, this is the same guy who made Rock the Bells. They, you know what I mean? They, and hip-hop, you know, certain hip-hop like myself, like, you know, when Jay-Z came to you for 99 Problems, we understand that. But I think a lot of motherfuckers don't understand this trajectory and this road you've traveled and you've paid. Because when I look at me, I did an album with Paul Banks last year, a couple of years ago. I think we did it in 2016, it came out 2017, right? Yeah. But it's called Banks and Stills. But it still is just on a road you carved already. You see remember me and the Black Keys was doing songs together, right? We didn't release it, but I remember they took it, they said, we're gonna take it to Rick and see what he thinks. Because if you don't like it, it ain't working. You know what I mean? But point being made is that you actually pioneered this melding. You know what I mean? So I just want to thank you for that. Because as a composer, you know, I have to do that anyway. And I always felt like at one point I was strictly hip hop, bro. I got nauseous from R&B. Right? And I didn't understand what rock was, because I didn't equate breakbeats with rock. But meanwhile, I'm cutting up Honky Tonk Woman. I'm cutting up Cerrone rocking in the pocket.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
I'm cutting up Back in Black, AC/DC. I'm cutting all that up. Another One Bites the Dust. Now, I think Another One Bites the Dust, he was inspired by the other. I think that might have been me's inspiration.
Might have been.
On that one. I think, yeah. But regardless, I'm cutting up these joints, all right? You know what's one I'm cutting up that's, I know we lost him this year. We lost him. Rush, Tom Sawyer. Nobody never really came off with that track yet. There's never really been a total hip-hop song off of that. I did 3 or 4 of them, never released them. Because I thought that break, Tom Sawyer, mother name, warrior, mean. So meanwhile, I'm not knowing that rock is always part of it. You know what I mean? A lot of our drums and break beats is coming from rock. We're not realizing it. But the man who I think did realize it is you. And I think you consciously added it to the music, yo.
I'll say that I rarely looked at it by genre. It was more the feeling that it gave me. You know, like I'll say, as a genre, I never really listened to R&B. I never really liked R&B. But I love James Brown and I love Barry White. You know, so like, right. But as a style, it didn't speak to me, but the cases spoke to me. Same is true in hip hop. I don't like all hip hop. I like certain flavors. Matter of fact, after leaving Def Jam and stopping doing hip hop for a while, I don't know if we ever talked about this before, but like when I started making hip hop, it was a very creative time in hip hop. Everyone who was doing it was finding their own way of doing it. And if you listen to the like the master mix shows on BLS or HBO or Kiss at that time during the Def Jam time, early, the mix shows, which was the only place you heard hip hop, by the way, it wasn't on the regular station. It would only be on the mix show.
You got 1 or 2 hours, baby. Yeah.
So if you listen to the mix show, the records didn't sound alike. They all sounded different. They were interesting, eclectic takes on what hip hop could be. And once the Def Jam records got very popular, I started listening to the mix shows and they just started sounding like all our records, whether we made them or not. It just felt like
it makes sense.
And it felt like, well, this community of people making interesting things isn't doing that anymore. Now they're just trying to follow the one that people liked. And that's it's boring. You know, it's like, it's almost like a conversation, you know, like you put out something and then somebody puts out something, you know, maybe not inspired by, but like they got a glimpse into what was possible because of something you made. And then they made something completely different and just as interesting. And then that right. would excite you. It's like, oh, wow, I never thought of it like that. That means right. that means we could go way over here now.
Right.
So it's like a...
So it died, that part of it died out.
So I kind of lost interest at that point. And that's when I started making more rock records. And then the two artists who got me excited about hip hop again were NWA and Wu-Tang. Those were the next, that was where like, oh, somebody cares again. Do you know what I mean? Like somebody's not just doing the same thing. They're new voices and it's exciting.
Well, thank you for that, bro.
It's truth.
Thank you for being one of those people, because I will say as a producer, what I thought I was doing, or what I didn't, and I love my hip hop peers, I didn't want nobody to say that my record was nothing else but hip hop. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think hip hop, after a while, we started wanting to be something else. You know what I mean? Like, you remember people, like everybody would put a reggae record on their album, or R&B record on their album, or, you know, because once LL made the love song, everybody got to make a love song. You know, it started, like you said, people started cookie cutting it. I was like, no category for me but hip hop. And I'm gonna give a fuck what nobody's doing. I don't care what they're doing. Like, you know, that's a bold thing. And you know what? I think, as I can say for myself, you actually lose that somewhere down the line. I lost that. You know, I lost that, like I said, when they started saying 100,000 a beat. You know what I mean? And it started being like, you know, I think when the radio grabbed control again, because the radio had lost control for a little while too.
Yeah.
When they grabbed control again, it was like, you got to make it for the radio. You got to be on this station. You know, I didn't even know, like, I learned later on that Hot 97 turned to hip hop station, that when they turned to hip hop station, it was based on the success of Wu. I learned that later.
Wow.
Yeah, there was a dance station, but the Wu songs was getting so much requested that it helped change their format.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then by the time we got to 1997, they stopped playing Wu. We got to like a war with them. But it's like, wow. And then we started trying to make something, or I as a producer, maybe around 1999, I would say, because 97 I still didn't care. But 1999, I started thinking, I want to make something so they could play it on the radio.
Yeah.
And it never worked for me.
No. Because that's not why you made it in the first place. That's not why people liked your music in the first place. It came from, you led the radio. They didn't lead you.
But like I said, it's a point. I guess it's a part in the artist. I know it's a part of my life that you have a doubt, right? You start thinking, the word is called conformity. Yeah. You begin to conform to what you think is normal. And at the end of the day, you lie to yourself, or you accept a lie.
Yeah.
And I think that happened to me. And I think I realized that, you know, that I actually became creatively weak. If you'll notice that after the year 2000, and I had a personal thing in my life, I lost my mother in the year 2000, I stopped. I left in 2001. I left New York and came to Cali, basically. I just became friends with Tarantino. I kind of understood. I just kind of understood music theory myself by studying books. And I was like, I want to be a composer. I had composed Ghost Dog. Took some critical, I got critical success out of it. And I was like, I want to do this, and I ended up just composing from the year 2000 up until 2005. All I did was compose movies. And then in 2005, I guess I showed up in a movie. And then they started putting me in movies, right? And then I wanted to be a director, and I kind of studied that for like 6 years. And then I became a director. And now, as a director, I will say, all my creative energy became stimulated. It was my music, my art, my visual, everything about creativity, my writing, it all was stimulated. It's actually, to me, the highest form of creative expression. A director who is considered an auteur, someone who actually writes it, all that. And so I became that, right? And I'm glad that I did. I'm satisfied in the life that it brought me. But after a few years, it took me to about 2000. It took, like I said, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. It's not that long ago that I became creatively free again. Like, I don't make music for no reason or nobody but for what RZA is doing for RZA. But if I want to be controlled, I'll go and do a movie. You know what I mean? Because in a movie, the character, if he's dying, he's dying. Okay? That's what it says in the script. Okay?
Yeah.
But musically, there's no way to control me anymore. And I feel grateful that, and not that I'm going to ever sell music again. I don't know what that means as far as on a commercial level. It doesn't have to mean nothing. I'm satisfied with the idea that it's not an economical need for me to do it.
Yeah.
And that economically, I have found the way to express art and get economics for it, which is my filmmaking career.
So. Right. It's a great place. Right. It's a great place to be. It's a great place to be where you can support yourself making art and then still be able to examine all of the different creative areas that are exciting to you, regardless right. of whether they're, you know, whether they're for commercial purposes or not.
Right. I agree, brother. Thank you.
How's your relationship with the other Wu, the rest of the Wu?
Always at peace. Beautiful. Always at peace, man. Yeah, we are brotherhood. My best example, Rick, is that I got a lawsuit. Lou Ugard is suing me, right? And this lawsuit been going on for about 3 years now, maybe the fourth year. And we was in Australia last year. They did a Wu-Tang tour in Australia, Sydney Opera House. And he gets there and his credit card isn't working. And so I put my credit card, put him in a suite, take care of everything for him. And then Jill's just like, only Wu could do that. This nigga's suing you and you feeding him and lending him money. I said, he's doing his business. I love this motherfucker. I love my brothers, man. And we have that, you know, we have that love for each other. And I think, and I'm proud, I think our parents should be proud to see that this was a community. Wu-Tang wasn't just, a bunch of guys like, you know, a lot of these bands, maybe two guys didn't know each other or whatever, you know, they put together. No, this is a group of men who, at minimum, 25, 30-year relationship. Some, me and Raekwon go back to the third grade, bro.
Amazing.
Yeah, so that's a blessing. And that part of it permeates and seems to, you know, trump anything else.
Yeah, beautiful. Cool, man. Thank you for talking.
Brother, thank you for having me, man. It's a blessing seeing you. Blessings to you, Rick. Bung, bung. Thanks, brother. Peace.
Thanks to RZA for catching up with Rick. You can hear all of our favorite RZA-produced songs by heading to BrokenRecordPodcast.com. And be sure to check out our YouTube channel where you can find some great bonus material from this interview. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube/BrokenRecordPodcast. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mia Lobel, Leah Rose, and Martin Gonzalez for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.